can't venture very far into our exploration of Genesis 1 without contending with the form in which it's been given to us. After all, the creation narrative isn't something to analyze and apply like a textbook. Instead, there's cadence and meter, there's rhythm and repetition. It's a poem, after all. Because of this, it was clear to me fairly early on that I wanted to discuss the ideas inside, creating in the image of a creator, of rest and reflection, of participating in the spirit-led recreation of all things, with someone who could address it as it is a poem. And I knew of no one better suited for that task than Malcolm Gait. Now, look, to be quite honest, I was very nervous to sit down with Malcolm, although that's not anything to do with his own posture. Rather, as a man so well-versed in poetry and literature, a captivating author and speaker, I knew all my insecurities would rise to the surface, and then the idea of having those like permanently imprinted on a podcast episode just made me feel a little ill. However, I also knew he would be the perfect interview subject to carry us further, to help illuminate the action to call it good. Talking to Malcolm about Genesis 1 turned out to be like drinking from a fire hose. Even in our pre-interview banner, before we even started recording, he was quoting off the top of his head Shakespeare and Keats, Wendell Berry and George Herbert, just based upon whatever subject I happened to bring up. He's a brilliant mind who is a poet and priest, author and chaplain of Girton College at the University of Cambridge. He's penned several books on theology and the arts, and several more of his own poetry anthologies. In short, we needed a poet to appreciate a poem. And that's exactly what you'll find on this episode with the wonderful Malcolm Gait. Hello and welcome to another episode of the Call It Good podcast here, part of the Rabbit Room Network. I'm thrilled to be joined today by Malcolm Gait. Malcolm, how are you today?
I'm fine. I'm glad to join you here and lovely to be part of another Rabbit Room thing.
Yeah, so appreciate you carving out time. You are into your evening as I'm into my afternoon. It's always funny to think about the way that works as the world goes around. Malcolm, I've been specifically very excited to talk to you in this series. We're just doing a short run here, talking to not very many people at all, because we just want to, you know, we want to explore this concept enough of being created in the image of a creator, and specifically that part of it about reflection and maybe looking back on what we have made or been a part of. And specifically, I've been excited to talk to you because the very subject that we're talking about comes to us from a poem. And as a poet yourself, I would love to hear from you how Genesis 1, how the creation narrative, maybe specifically what we're talking about, how that informs your work as a poet.
Well, thank you. Yeah, I mean, I'm very glad you referred to Genesis 1 as a poem there, because it's a highly poetic text. And it's a poem which I think it's a text that seems to have arisen partly out of almost like call and response, collective poetry and ritual. The way at the end of each day, and it was evening and it was morning the first day, and you know, and it was evening, it was morning the second day. And the constantly repeated phrase, and God said, and it was, and behold, it was good. There's a wonderful sense of a kind of choral, almost musical series of refrains and motifs running through that. And that's why, you know, it works so well when it's read out loud, and when it's read out loud, as it were, antiphonally in parts. So, yes, I think it is a piece of poetry. And, of course, it's a poetry about poetry in the deepest sense, in that, you know, the Greek word poiein, from the verb from which we get the words poet and poetry, is means to make. A poet is a maker. I mean, it's actually the verb that's used in the beginning of John's Gospel, that wonderful text, which of course riffs on Genesis 1 and opens with the same words. You know, when we say without him was not anything made that was made, the made word there is poiein, poeted, you know. And I think there's a sense not only in which Genesis 1 is poetry, but that is, it's poetry about poetry in the sense that God, as it, whom I call in one of my poems, the triune poet makes us for his glory, is speaking the world into being as poetry, as a physical poetry. I mean, we mortal poets have to work with words, which are wonderful, but in comparison with the whole cosmos, perhaps quite a thin medium. Whereas God makes his poems with the cosmos itself, just as he makes his myth, if you like, his great salvific story, not simply in words, but in fact, when the word is made flesh in Christ and he speaks it into history.
How has your understanding of this unfolded and impacted your work? Like, if you think about what maybe you believed about this, you know, a while ago or when you were first starting your craft, I guess I just wonder, as your understanding grows, how your application grows.
Yes, well, in fact, you know, although I was brought up in a Christian household, like probably quite a lot of kids who are, I kind of turned my back on it in my teenage years. And at about the same time, I was getting into poetry. And as it happens, poetry in that sense became, if not a substitute religion, a kind of alternative one. It was where I began to get my value from. So I first learned to love poetry and begin to craft it myself outside of the frame of faith. And in a sense, I couldn't find, therefore, its deepest resonances. But when I returned to faith in a much fuller way as a young adult in my final year at university, one of the effects on it was to suddenly put poetry back in its proper place, both in one sense, a lesser place, in the sense that I knew my salvation came from God's love for me in Christ and not from a Keats poem, beautiful and healing as many of Keats's poems are. So in one sense, I was putting, as C.S. Lewis says, you know, put first things first and you get the second things thrown in. But if you put second things first, you don't even get the second thing in the end. So in one sense, poetry re-centered, and I thought about the fullness and the beauty of God and Christ as my savior. But eventually I began to see how the whole biblical narrative and the whole salvation story, and the, particularly the astonishing revelation at the beginning of John's gospel that Christ is, one way to understand Christ is that he is Hologos, the Word, that actually began to reframe poetry. And I can almost remember the point at which the penny dropped, because there's a very famous and beautiful passage in A Midsummer Night's Dream about poetry, where one of the characters describes how the poet works. And I knew that passage extremely well and loved it, and it had become something of a mantra for me about what poetry is and how it works. You may remember it. It's the bit that goes, the poet's eye in fine frenzy rolling doth glance from heaven to earth, from earth to heaven. And as imagination bodies forth the form of things unknown, the poet's pen turns them to shapes and gives to airy nothing a local habitation and a name. A very beautiful account of poetry. But I was rereading that one day, having come to faith and having particularly loved both the Genesis narrative and what is effectively the Johannine commentary on it. And I suddenly realized that this great account of what poetry is was actually framed and couched in terms of incarnation, that it starts with the idea of heaven and earth and how do you connect them, you're glancing from one to the other. And then it uses this key word, bodies. Imagination bodies forth the form of things unknown. And then it talks about making a habitation and giving a name to the heavenly things so that it can be bodied forth in earth. And I suddenly realized, oh my goodness, that's exactly what God is doing in Christ, in the incarnation. In fact, the very first question in John's gospel, of riffing on Genesis again, because of course the first question from God to humanity in Genesis is, where are you? You know, when we're hiding. And the first question from humanity to God in John, in when they meet Jesus, is, Master, where is your habitation? Where are you staying? And he says, come and see. So it's about this meeting with God, which is enabled face to face, actually seeing, beholding his glory. Why? Because, as it were, God, the divine poet, has bodied forth who he really is, not in a poem, but in a person. And I came to see that all our own creativity is in a sense, having a go at that. Bodying forth something, giving it a habitation, giving it a name, making the previously only apprehended, the invisible, the glimpsed, making that a place and a space and a name and a known and a form and an art, and then giving it to people so that they can enter into it and encounter something which is beyond form and beyond material. And so I see not just the act of creation in Genesis, but in a sense, the new creation in Christ as not only paradigms or, you know, if you like, templates for what our creative process is, but the fundamental gift and ground without which there would be no creativity at all.
Mm. Gosh, I love that. I love that whole connection. You just mentioned, you know, God's activity in terms of not only the you know, giving it the habitation and a name, like you said, but then you said, you know, then it's giving to people that a way that they can enter in, and that particular part of the process is under our microscope. And I guess I wonder what thoughts you have there. Does that feel accurate to say that we are called to participate in that as well, to create and then give it to others to enter into?
Yes, absolutely. I think, and this is really important because I think some of the arts took a wrong turn in the sort of romantic and post-romantic era where it became so-called self-expression, where it just became like inner things about your inner self and you write them because you have to, but it doesn't matter if nobody gets them, you know, and it becomes turned in on itself. And I think that's bad for the spirit and bad for art. I think art always has to have characters of gift and grace, that it has to carry with it an invitation to come in and see something and find something, that it has to be not only generous, but also generative. It has to create a place in a space that people can have access to. It doesn't mean that they access everything instantly. You know, you go into somebody else's habitation, it may take quite a long time to get to know them. And they may have many more things to say to you years after you first walked through their door. But there has to be a welcome to walk through the door. There has to be something open. I think in that sense, if you want to use the term habitation, a good work of art in any medium has to have both doors and windows. That is to say, it's got to have something that opens up sufficiently to invite you in. And then it's got to give you some new views and some new perspectives. The poem that sort of first made me want to be a poet, the sort of revelation poem for me while I was still an atheist shading into agnostic, but the thing that made me feel there's something here and I need to do it, was Keats's poem Ode to a Nightingale, which starts quite unpromisingly with this, you know, my heart aches and a drowsy numbness pains my sense, as though of hemlock I had drunk or emptied some dull opiate to the drains. 1 minute passed and Lethe woods had sunk, it's got all pain drains dull, you know, and then it suddenly lifts off because of the bird. But you may remember there's a literally magical moment when just towards the end of the poem, towards the back of the poem, is it, when we're walking through it, he suddenly, and there's no logical reason for this, it's just an image that swims up. He suddenly gives you the image of windows, which he calls magic casements opening. Magic casements opening on perilous seas in fairy lands forlorn. And just as you get the glimpse of the windows opening, he calls you back at the end of the poem. Forlorn, the very word is like a bell to toll me back from thee to my soul self. But just, you know, if you keep going into the habitation of that poem, there are windows at the back of it that look on these perilous seas, and you want to go there and look out of them. And so I think there's a double thing in art. There's something homely and welcoming, but there's always got to be something mysterious and transcendent that you find inside the house of welcome and that beckons you beyond.
What does that idea of inviting people in mean for you in terms of a tangible, like as you write yourself or have written in the past, has that proven difficult for you to invite people in at times?
I think it depends. I think it's a thing you learn. Sometimes, you know, if the subject of the poem that presents itself is dark or difficult, you sometimes want to say, does anybody really want to see this? And I think you have to distinguish quite clearly in your mind between therapy and poetry. There may be certain things you want to write, out of which a poem into which other people can be invited will emerge, but that might have to be crafted from it as a different poem. I mean, to take a contemporary example, it's quite well documented that when Bob Dylan started what became Like a Rolling Stone, he says he wrote about 10 pages of screed, and he actually used a very powerful and, you know, in some senses, repellent word. He said he vomited it onto the page, you know. But out of that, he crafted a song, which is true to the original things. It's full of the bitterness and the difficulties and the senses of isolation and the mockery. But it's also full of extraordinary beauty and power and resonance. And you do, you know, from that first rim shot on the drum, it's like the crack of a starting pistol. You know, you really want this to run this race. You want to go into this song poem again and again. And what it does is provide you with endless phrases which will come back to you when you've got nothing. You've got nothing to lose. You know, do you read that as bleak, or do you read that as astonishingly promising and beautiful as the new grace that starts at the zero point, you know? So Dylan had to do something between, if you like, the private vomitific 10 pages and the beautifully crafted song that we can hear and sing and be invited into. And that's where the art and craft of poetry comes. I think there's been an unfortunate thing, you know, with the kind of free verse and resistance to form, and sometimes people preferring just strength of expression to craft, that there's been some contemporary poetry that doesn't do that second stage and just splurges. You know, and I think sometimes that's not successful. But I think the best poems and the ones we keep are the ones where a habitation has been built out of this original material, however dark the original material was.
This rhythm, this poetic rhythm that we find in Genesis 1 has this sort of, you know, like you mentioned, the ordering of the day, and then therefore a breath at the end of the day with which to sort of exhale this declaration over the day. That involves some level of Sabbath. I wonder what that means for you and your own practice. Like, do you try to have a rhythm to even the work schedule? Yeah.
It's interesting. Yeah, I do think you do have to have a rhythm to the work schedule. I think that's very true. But I think there also has to be a Sabbath moment arising out of composition, and probably several. I mean, there's one sense in which to write a good poem at all, you have to be in love with it. You have to love it and want it to be. But of course, in the first flush of enthusiasm, it's all good, you know. Then you have to pause and look at it more dispassionately and make it better. But then there has to come a point before you can finish the poem. In fact, this is how you know the poem is finished. When in a kind of Sabbath moment, as it were, you contemplate it, you read it again. You read it as though you were someone else. You imagine somebody in some circumstance that, you know, you're not in reading it, and you wonder, do you know what I mean? And then you contemplate the thing itself, and you say, have I got this right? Does every word I've used serve the other words and serve the poem? Not serve me, and me as I am after writing the poem, but serve the wholeness of the poem itself. Is it a whole? And when it is, then you have to say, you know, tof, I think, is the Hebrew word, isn't it? It's good. It means actually juicy, fresh, you know, this is good. And of course, we, particularly in Christian culture, where, you know, we're all taught to be humble and so on, and there's a kind of false humility in which you try and pretend that a good thing is not good because you happen to have made it. I mean, the real test is, would you love it just as much if somebody else had written it? I mean, one of the moments you often have as a poet, you know, when you read a really good poem, the fallen part in you says, oh, I wish I'd written that, because you want to claim it in some way. But then that fallen part is rightly rebuked by the risen part in you that says, oh, thank God somebody wrote this. This is great. It's just great that this poem should exist. And ideally, there should come a point where if you've written something worth reading, you can say, as it were, fully, behold, it is good. It's great that this poem exists. It so happens that you wrote it. But you would say it with the same satisfaction if somebody else had written it.
You mentioned this, the politeness of the Christian culture. could like even the way we say like a false humility still sounds polite. I mean, is there like, I mean, should we think even about that in darker terms? So it strikes us as more wrong than maybe some term like false humility. I mean, should we think of that as sin? Should we think of that as at least as something more striking than just false humility? Well, are we missing something there by not doing it?
It's a sin to call a good thing bad. I mean, it's clearly a sin to call a good person bad, and it, you know, it's good. But, you know, it's really interesting, the only point at which Jesus talks about the sin against the Holy Spirit and the impossibility of that being forgiven is when they say about when he's just healed somebody. Clearly and evidently to everybody, a good thing to have done. And they say he has a devil. That's the point at which Jesus really rebukes them. Yeah. Not in a sense because of what they're saying about him, but because what they're saying about the evident goodness of the thing he's just done. I mean, the reason why they say it is it's not convenient for them to be a God-appointed healer because he doesn't qualify in their terms, and because the way God works with him is a challenge to their structures of power. That's why they want to exclude him and marginalize him and put him down. But in order to do so, they have to deny and pervert the evidence of their own eyes. Now, that's an extreme example. But it's an example of somebody failing to see the goodness of a good work for purely ulterior reasons. And of course, that happens in lots of other contexts. I mean, to go back to my beloved Keats, I mean, Keats was absolutely savaged in a review by the Edinburgh Quarterly for entirely political reasons. He was associated with Leigh Hunt, who was a liberal who was campaigning for various kinds of law reforms. And he was essentially a working class person. And the reviewer put him down as part of the quote unquote Cockney school of poetry. And the reviewer could not say, I mean, everybody without exception would now regard the poems in that book as amongst the finest things ever written in the English language. But the reviewer couldn't see it because they had a series of quite extrinsic reasons for wanting not to like it. Now, we might say the same, curious enough, we might be in a situation where we might have extrinsic reasons for wanting not to like our own work. And we would be wrong if we put it down for those reasons. If we could, we have to recognize the goodness of a good thing wherever we find it, including, surprisingly enough, in our own works.
It can feel counter because of maybe the way many of us were raised or conditioned to not put ourselves out there in terms of the sharing or the proclaiming of this as like, hey, look at this thing that I've done. Like you said, this yeah. False humility.
I mean, there is, of course, a radical way out of this. And, you know, maybe eventually we'll take it. It's the way that the great medieval artists, the people who made the cathedrals, for example, took, which was to do it entirely anonymously. So since your name isn't attached to it, there's no danger of your bigging up your ego. You can just put it out there and then it becomes a thing in itself. And some people, you know, write under a sort of nom de plume for that reason. But I mean, counter to that, I think one of the pleasures we get in reading a poet over the long arc of their work is to see their personal development, or a songwriter for that matter, and feel a growing personal relationship with them. So I'm glad we own our work and put our names to it. But I do think it sometimes casts a shadow. Either we don't praise it because we think that would be self-praise, or in some cases people do actually use the praise of their own work as a sort of prop to their egos, and you know that's folly as well. I mean, in the end, I take the view that a work of art, when it's made, has a life of its own. I mean, the analogy for me would be having children and watching them grow up. Of course you love your children, of course you're partial to your children and you think they're the best. But the main thing is that once they've grown up, they should go out and do their own thing. And then you look at your children through other people's eyes. They make new friends. They come home wearing different clothes. And you suddenly see them and say, oh, they've made a good job of it. You know, you kind of delight. You know what I mean? And sometimes their friends show you things about them and reveal facets of them that you're delighted to see, but that you didn't see because you're almost too close to see them. And that is sometimes happily the experience of a poet, particularly now, actually, in the internet age. Obviously, back in the day when you published a book of poems, you know, you waited a year and then you finally got a review. And the review was the first echo back from the vast gulf of silence into which you dropped your poem. Now, of course, you know, you put it on your blog or whatever and people write to you. And I mean, I get a lot of correspondence, I mean, about my poetry. Not all of it's helpful, but quite a lot of it is just little bits of testifying from people to say, this poem landed in my in tray on such and such a day, and I really needed it then. Thank you. Or somebody writes me and says, you know, I keep your book of poems by my bedside, and I read this at such and such a time, and it really helped, you know. So, and I don't think that's, I mean, I think that's actually very helpful to a poet to know how it's going, how people are feeling about it. I mean, there are dangers. You don't want to end up, you know, just constantly trying to write lines that will please your last fan, you know. But you can be encouraged in doing the thing you think you're called to do if you see it's actually connecting with and helping people.
Yeah.
And I've been, you know, very blessed in that respect.
Yeah. By the way, on the other side for you, as a reader, or even as a listener, if that's the art, do you remember the last piece of art that invited you in a way that made you thankful, see something different, that would make you want to reach out to the maker and say, "Gosh, this landed for me in just the right way"?
Yeah, I was just recently reading some of the poems of a great West Indian, a Christian West Indian poet, John Robert Lee. And he's got a series called Canticles. And he's got a wonderful canticle of the resurrection where he starts like with this really bleak statement, like death is the end and that's it and it's everything. And, you know, it's all finished. It's like a real shutdown opening. And then the next verse starts, except. And it goes like, except for the folded linen, except for the empty tomb, except for the stone. And then finally says, except for the punctured hand holding your wounded hand. You know, and it's this one, it's just amazingly good, you know.
Oh, that's good. So
I do a little thing. I have a little, when lockdown happened, one of the things I most missed was the idea that students could just knock on my door and walk into me with my study, and we'd have a chat about anything, and I would just pull a book off the shelf and randomly read them a poem. So I started doing that on YouTube in a thing called A Spell in the Library. So just recently, because that poem of John Robert Lee's had so moved me, I mean, he was part of that. There was an amazing literary renaissance in the West Indies, and particularly around St. Lucia, where Derek Walcott, the great Nobel laureate, was. And he was one of a circle of poets around Walcott. But Walcott, because Walcott was great and because he happened to win the Nobel Prize, it's a bit like Heaney winning the Nobel Prize in Ireland. There's a bunch of other great poets around those people who kind of get in the shadow because, you know, big high-end literary culture works just like the Hollywood star system, and they tend to get one person and they can only cope with one genius at a time. But sometimes culture will be clever of them. So John Robert Lee happens to be one of the others who is, you know, much admired by Walcott and very powerful. Anyway, so I was reading this poem and I thought, God, this is really good and we really need to hear this. So I was able just quickly, you know, to do one of my spells in the library and share it. And lots of people, you know, and he wrote to me, he saw it, he said, thank you so much for sharing my poem. Yeah. So it's really nice to get this connection.
So your message made its way back to the maker.
Yeah, which is really nice.
Oh, that's great.
One of the, you know, obviously a lot of the, obviously with, you know, I can't walk in, go and say hello to C.S. Lewis or Keats, but although I feel they're very strongly friends and inhabitants of my mind, but it is great. You know, when you can meet, I was very fortunate towards the end of his life to get to know Seamus Heaney a little and spend some time with him. And that was an incredible blessing to me. I mean, just to have a poet like that encouraging me. And I'm pretty conscious of wanting to do the same as far as I can, you know, with others. Although, of course, again, in the age of the internet, I'm always haunted by this thing, you know, that C.S. Lewis answered all the letters he'd been sent. But then, of course, he didn't live in the age of the internet and emails and, you know, and then his brother to do the typing out for him. But you can't do it everybody. But when you can, when it's humanly possible, to respond to a reader and encourage them is something that, you know, I try to do. I don't necessarily always get it right. Sorry for the ping there.
Speaking of, maybe it's someone reaching out to you.
Yeah, it probably is. And, you know, it's obviously there's a sense that if you did nothing but that, I mean, you know, people send you stuff and hope that you might critique it for you. And there's a point where you think, if I just did this all the time, I'd never write anything else at all. I very tend to, when people write to me like that, I do strongly encourage them to join a local writers group. And if there isn't one, to form it for themselves, you know, again, thinking of the Inklings and how they read one another's work and worked with each other and helped each other on that. Because that's another sense, talking about our being made by a maker. I mean, the image of God in us is the image of God, the Holy Trinity. It's the image of a communion of persons. So it's not a monolithic image. It's an image of a communion of love. And I actually think that that's another thing we need to get away from. Again, it's a sort of hangover from the Romantic era, much as I love the Romantics, which is the idea of the artist as the lonely, angst-ridden, isolated genius writing in his garret, only to be understood a century later, communicating with no one. You know, I think that's a very false, that sort of pseudo image of the poet. And I think we are meant to be people in communion and community, and language is a medium of communion and communication. So I think we have to write with and through and for and encouraged by one another. Something I put fairly strongly in my my poem for Trinity Sunday, which is very much about the Genesis narrative and our own reflection of that in our creative work. I mean, I don't know, this might be the place to read it. Would you like to?
Yeah, please. We discussed earlier that we'd love for you to read this, so please.
So this is, the poem's called Trinity Sunday, which is, even that is borrowed, even that is part of, because my great mentor, the priest poet George Herbert, 17th century priest poet, also wrote a poem called Trinity Sunday. It happened that the readings for the Trinity Sunday that I was writing this about were Genesis 1 and 1:1. So it goes like this. In the beginning, not in time or space, but in the quick before both space and time, in life, in love, in co-inherent grace, in three in one in three, in rhyme, in music, in the whole creation story, in his own image, his imagination, the triune poet makes us for his glory and makes us each the other's inspiration. He calls us out of darkness, chaos, chance, to improvise a music of our own, to sing the chord that calls us to the dance, three notes resounding from a single tone, to sing the end in whom we all begin, our God, beyond, beside us, and within. So I think the relevance there to what we were just discussing was, you know, triune poet makes us for his glories and makes us each the other's inspiration. That's the point. You know, people say to me, oh, you know, aren't you afraid as a poet of the blank piece of paper, of sitting down in front of the blank piece of paper? And I say, there is no blank piece of paper. You belong to a community of language. I mean, the only thing that gives me courage to be a poet at all is the conviction that all the words I use are older and wiser than I am. You know, they've been around, they've got stories to tell, they've got, you know, the very fact that I use language at all means I belong to community and intend to communicate. And in a sense, all the other poets I've known and loved are crowding round my little hut and are at my shoulder, helping me as I write.
Gosh, I love that. I loved your poem. Thank you so much for sharing with us. Malcolm, it's certainly a pleasure to chat with you today about all this. You've been so kind and generous with your time.
Pleasure.
Call It Good is brought to you by the Rabbit Room Podcast Network, where art nourishes community and community nourishes art. To listen to all the podcasts on our network, visit rabbitroom.com/podcasts. The work we do at the Rabbit Room wouldn't be possible without the generous support of our membership. If you're a member, thank you for being a part of what is happening here. To learn more about membership and help us continue to create works like this, visit rabbitroom.com/membership.